I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
I'm afraid this is about the least interesting of the ideas Leanne has had for this event, which have included a candlelit vigil, a seance, and everyone should tell their own ghost story. So we might end up at that. But I just wanted to kind of introduce this book slightly. I mean, as probably most of you know, Leanne does write the most kind of original books with a kind of mix of text and image. And I think this is her most kind of crazy and far out and wonderful book so far. Possibly the most related book, I think, is Toys Talking, your children's book, but we can talk about that later. And what I wanted to do is just sort of what we thought, partly because this is all about, I think, kind of the relationship of words and images. We wanted to actually start by doing a slightly crazy experiment where we'll read one of the stories with no images whatsoever. And this is the... So, for Leanne, if you introduce it, and then we'll...
See, you pronounce this word differently than I do.
I'm sure you pronounce it correctly.
I pronounce it Eidolon, but you pronounce it Eidolon.
If. That's fine. Let's call the whole thing off.
Okay. So, Adam is going to read... I suppose there's sort of stage directions. This story is illustrated by final scene in Death in Venice, where in the movie, not in the novel, the photographic version of Death in Venice, where Tadzio sort of wades out into the water and does this sort of little turn and then points. So Adam will read the Visconti Badalucco version of that. Okay. Death in Venice. Okay.
62, beach, Hotel des Bains, exterior. Tadzio has waded idly through the water and reached the sandbar. To Aschenbach's eyes, the boy seems an improbable apparition against a foggy background without end.
As she's carried to the car after a Christmas party, she nests her head in her father's neck. The purple sky is like her fingers, and the wind is cold and smells old. Her father sets her on the back seat, fastens her seatbelt. She's small, smells like sweet hair and pee, turds like little birds collect in her pull-up. Her lead levels are normal. Her sneeze, like a wet tissue, dropped on the floor.
Aschenbach rests his head against the chair back, his arms relaxed at his sides, his head turned to watch the movements of the figure out there.
The car follows the cloverleaf onto a highway. The beam of a streetlight touches the hood and guides the vehicle along until the next beam picks it up. She falls asleep. Horns on Fifth Avenue. She's 43 and has opened the kitchen window so the paint fumes won't linger with the fettuccine, the strawberries, the water lemon.
As though struck by a sudden recollection or by an impulse, Tadzio turns from the waist up in an exquisite movement. One hand resting on his hip, he looks over his shoulder at the shore.
Her breath is eggy in the back seat. She stirs and looks at a defrosting windshield in Bavaria. Blooms of clarity spread across the glass. 13 years ago, she saw La Boheme. He picked her up in a town car on Jane Street. She wore a black corduroy suit and a pink scarf. They looked at the program, and he asked her who the woman in the Lancome ad was. Musetta is with Elsindoro. Mimi dies.
Tadzio looks long at the beach where Aschenbach sits.
She goes again to La Boheme, this time with Rodolfo. They sit in the parterre. They both have a cold. She is who she was becoming. Happy. From the Taittinger, she sees a shimmer of who she was the last time Mimi died. They used to live in the building that Bob Dylan walks in front of on a snowy day on the record sleeve for the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. It's the one on the right directly across the street from the blue VW camper van. Dylan and his girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, snuggle past a white Chevy parked in front of what is now a butcher's.
Aschenbach lifts his head as though in answer to Tadzio's gaze.
She'd step outside to see a couple posing for that picture, another friend shooting the tableau vivant, or sometimes it would just be one person who would have propped a camera or phone against a Pepsi can or something, set to self-timer while they strolled down the middle of the street toward it. This happened at least once a week. The sound of poets dying in gutters. The song Bob Dylan's Dream is based on the folk ballad Lady Franklin's Lament, which is about a tragic Victorian expedition to the Arctic in 1845, involving two ships, the Erebus and the Terror. In 1829, Edgar Allan Poe wrote these verses in his poem, Dreamland. Where an Eidolon named Night on a black throne reigns upright, I've reached these lands but newly from an ultimate dim Thule. The beam of a streetlight touches the hood and guides the car along until the next beam picks it up. There are three mailboxes on the sidewalk in front of the post office. It's closed and a couple are kissing against the first mailbox. They're kissing on the street where a different couple ran through the rain, covered by an extra large garbage bag, late for a dinner inside a museum.
Aschenbach starts to bow his head and it falls heavily on his chest. His eyes are troubled, but his face assumes a restful expression, absorbed, as though he is sleeping soundly.
Later, the woman was angry when the man talked too long to another woman. So she began talking to a different man, and they ordered drinks. When he found her talking to the different man, the first man took the glass from her hand and drank from it. The other woman had once waited for the man, waited and wished, then had given up. He wished too, now he waits.
Down there on the sandbar, divided by an expanse of water from the shore, it seems as though the boy smiles and, raising his hand from his hip, indicates a distant place on the horizon.
There's a couple kissing against the first of three mailboxes in front of the post office. It's getting dark and a woman waits on the post office steps for a car to arrive to take her and her daughter home. It's on the same street where a couple once ran through the rain late for dinner. She loved him, loved him, loved him, loved him. At the dinner, the man ran into a woman by whom he was once loved, but whom he didn't love. He wanted to love her, but now he loves the woman with whom he ran through the rain. Now he waits for her and her daughter. Now the other woman has a son. It's getting dark, and a woman waits on the post office steps for a car to arrive to take her and her daughter home. Despite her friends buying her an expensive fur muff and shoving her hands into it, Mimi dies. Did it kind of work? What did you see in your head? I don't know if it worked or not. Thanks for enduring our experiment.
Because I can't quite show this. Each page of that story has a kind of frame, like a still.
Like a still of the...
The boy, like a silhouette. It's like that phrase in cartoons, the silhouette of passage, you know, where like a character goes through a wall and then they leave their silhouette. But I guess my kind of question first here is like, you know, these are called ghost stories. So who are the ghosts in that story?
The ghosts are, it's sort of anything that repeats. I mean, the book is so much about photography too, so it's about how we can look at a picture a million times. It's about the after image. It's about our need to look. And so I think in that story, it's attending two versions of La Boheme. It's the little girl in the back seat and the 43-year-old woman. It's the different Mimis, and it's these repetitions romantically of what happens when time is imperfect, essentially, mm-hmm. as time is. So all of the characters are ghosts. And I loved how in Death in Venice, and this is why I used that scene on the beach and in the novel. Well, Thomas Mann in the novel actually writes there's a view camera on the beach, which is presumably for, you know, the tourists. And Visconti puts a view camera on the beach in the last scene too. And so I'm always thinking sort of, what is that camera seeing? And in this case, it was sort of this frame, that movement.
And then why, like, I know that watercolor is one of the kind of media you really like using. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you do it the other way around, as it were?
Put the pictures in.
Yeah.
I did it, and it was in the layout for the longest time. And then I thought, I love painting from photographs. So I thought, what would it look like if I abstracted it one level and made it what is in our head and in our memory as a slightly more precious object, which is a painting, right?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to both abstract it abstract a photographic image into painting, which is something that I remember seeing Gerhard Richter do really early on and just going like, okay, the world has changed. This is really interesting. So I love painting from photographs. So that was a... And I didn't want to pay for copyright. So...
But it's kind of interesting because it's like what you're saying about this idea of the repetition, because it also reminded me almost of an after image. You know, it looks like kind of when there's a flash. I'm interested what you say about it, because like to me, like one thing that I found fascinating about this was that obviously normally what we're used to with the idea of the ghost is the idea of the supernatural, of the kind of metaphysical. And although there are kind of hints of those kind of stories, actually like one of the kind of main emotions I kind of found going through this is actually like there's a huge kind of sadness almost in this book to do with very ordinary human like flaws and failures and then attempts to put things back together that are broken. Mm-hmm. That in many senses there's no supernatural going on at all in most of these stories.
Yeah. I mean, I love Henry James's ghost stories.
Yeah.
And I think in almost all of them but Turn of the Screw, there's very little supernatural going on. And I like that he kind of said these are the ghostly tales of our time. And I just wanted to go, what are the ghostly tales of our time? And I think they all involve photography. And gosh, you just said something that struck me. The sadness, like that our idea of memory is inflected by photos. There's something about metaphysical. What was it? Anyway, I'm losing it. But.
Well, I guess like, it was reminding me of that kind of Freud essay on the uncanny as well. You know, that again, that's all about repetition, compulsion, and kind of repetitions that maybe you don't notice. And the uncanny, I think, seems to be one place where these two ideas come together, where it's both something that could be seen as supernatural, but has, like, because the interesting, in the Henry James stories, what I find interesting is that they often have a kind of rational explanation. Mm-hmm. There's often someone to whom the story is being told who comes up with the non-scary kind of version of the event. So that, like,
the skeptic or the,
And I kind of feel here, there's almost something being done kind of where actually, like, emotions that we're being used to kind of see treated in short stories in an ordinary way of like everyday short stories here become quite uncanny. And I guess one question is do you think it's partly because of your use of constantly text and image together?
Mm-hmm. I also think I'm using very deliberately text and image together, but I'm using them in design conventions we all know how to read in a very banal way. We're like, oh, a list of illustrations. I know how to read that. But if it's being used, but then you don't see the illustrations, then it because something's missing and we're filling it in and we have a sense of uncertainty about what we're filling it in with and yet we are still doing it. Mm. I think that can contribute to the uncanny.
It's also to do with like this art of juxtaposition. You know, like I started making a list of kind of all the different structures for each story so that you might get descriptions of a shark and notes from a cruise menu. Mm-hmm. And another story is floor plans with sort of notes on a child or, you know, like the one we just read, like kind of in one sense, there's no relationship between the last frames of Death in Venice and this story of a kind of Manhattan love affair or like, and it did seem related, like I was kind of wondering what your tradition is, and what, because to me, they seem very much coming out of a kind of surrealist art form of...
I see what you mean, yeah.
But maybe that's completely wrong.
No, I think, I like multi-channel. I mean, I'll sort of go, okay, I'm going to give you a picture, a caption of the picture that is a literal caption and something that is happening at the same time, and I use this example a lot where I talk about the Bloomberg monitor, where there's about four different pieces of information. That's easy. Like, we know how to read that. And I want to do that with, we know how to read that, numbers, words, news, temperature, whatever, at the same time. It's funny, it could also be paired with anything, and that plays into my idea of time, again, being layered. Mm. This going on at the same time that this is going on, which is a lot of, you know, the traditional ghost stories. There's something that happened in this room and we're getting an after image or an after effect of it, and ley lines and sort of waves. And so I wanted there to be a sense of something else going on kind of always in these stories. Or, you know, with the floor plans, there's a piece where I take floor plans, but I I almost, there's like this Winchester house in the States where this woman sort of wanted to outrun ghosts, so she built rooms that had no staircases into brick walls and rooms that had no exits and all this. So I sort of took these regular floor plans to sort of suburbs and just in Photoshop was like, copy, click, whatever, just put them as though they were in the mind of someone demented. And my grandmother was going mental at the time, and my mother kept notes on what she would say and do. And I wanted to understand. Okay. They put fences up in my parents' house so she wouldn't hurt herself, and there was all this stuff. So again, there's a sense of what we know how to read, which is a floor plan, but in fact, it being an impossible floor plan, and then observing it through, you know, my mother's notes. I'm not answering your question at all, but those notes could exist without those floor plans, or those floor plans could exist as little illustrations that you'd have to look at closely. But
yeah, but it's something about what they produce together is a much more interesting toy for thinking.
Definitely.
They kind of, because I'm interested, like our mutual friend Sheila, like I'm just noticing in her blurb for this, Sheila Hetty kind of describes kind of a world of images and captions, and I was kind of thinking about this, because for some reason, like, I know what she means, but it seems to me that caption doesn't capture what you're doing here, because a caption to me is something so much smaller. And I think one thing that's fascinating here is it's almost as if you've kind of blown up the idea of a caption, that we're used to an idea that a mm-hmm. caption might fix an image mm-hmm. And be a short sort of segment of text that is somehow going to then, if every image could have kind of multiple interpretations, the caption is there to kind of prevent that.
But what I try to do is actually...
is to kind of widen it out.
Widen it out, yeah.
I'm kind of interested in what the kind of other models for you of a book like this are. Like, I was trying to kind of think to myself, what does this remind me of? And I couldn't, like, I was kind of coming up with weird, like, things like André Breton's novel Nadia, which also has photos, or like Rob Grier's, like, kind of Ciné Roman of Last Year at Marienbad, which is kind of another ghostly kind of story. But, like, I didn't know if those were completely off and whether you'd actually go with something much more design, like, whether actually these, like...
Well, a lot of it comes from design, and a lot of it comes from wanting to, like, as you know, the, you know, novel in the form of the auction catalog, it was sort of saying, okay, how can I sustain a story through an auction catalog? In this case, what I saw was a copy of White Mischief on Holiday, just a crappy little copy with, you know, paperback, pulpy paper, very grainy images. And it has two photo signatures. I call them photo signatures, but the plates section.
Yeah.
And I was looking at, there's a little nod to it in the book, but I was looking at a caption that said, boy, whatever's body in the footwell of the Buick. And I was looking at the picture for about 5 minutes trying to see the body, but because of the reproduction and the pulpiness of the paper and the age of this paperback, I couldn't see a thing, but I just loved that I was wrapped. Like, I was just like, where's the body? Like, and I thought, oh, I want a 350-page book that's just the photo, and just, can I sustain one story over 350 pages using the convention that we all have of, like, oh, it's telling me what's there, I'm going to believe it.
Yeah.
And focus on it. So I tried it, and I think I actually showed Luke some of that. I didn't think it was working, because it's sort of like, by the 10th page, you're like, I get it. Like, I get what you're trying to do. Even though I think it still could work. But then I wanted to break it up into the conventions of design and book publishing that we all recognize, like those photo signatures, like list of illustrations, like samples of wallpaper with the name of them underneath. All of these things that we're used to, like a grid now because of Instagram and eBay, all of these things we're used to, but also with language, the tone of the caption, you know, with the Greenland shark, with this National Geographic tone, this tone that's supposed to inspire trust, or a national trust tone when it came to real estate and houses and architecture, playing with our sense of trust when it comes to how we listen to and how that language works. I'm sort of losing the thread a little bit, but yeah, I think when what I want a reader to see when they come to these is very, very familiar ways of reading. but then go, okay, what am I, like, what mm. is coming off the page that maybe I haven't thought about before?
Yeah. Because I think then from a kind of, as it were, almost from the literary point, it's like kind of the other way around. One thing I found so fascinating about this book is kind of almost what it then tells you about the economy that a story can be capable of, that actually there can be like huge submerged narrative or narrative potential in almost just a series of photos if they have the right kind of caption. That these are, that, you know, these are, this is a book of short stories. And one thing I think that's kind of interesting is just the kind of amount of latent kind of story that you can find. I'm just trying to think, like, it's almost as if there are
multiple. Latent's a good word because, again, photography.
Yeah.
The idea that everything was a latent image before photography was invented. It's not like images weren't latent before silver nitrate and bitumen of Judea and now the cloud or digital. I don't know. There's something about the word latency that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's almost, I feel like one of the stories that's almost like an allegory of like the whole book is, I can't remember what the title is now, but it's where the someone is taking a video and they think they see, like in the video, suddenly there is a person crosses the frame. And it seems like, I thought that so spoke to so much of what actually we've used photography for, which is, you know, like going back to kind of ectoplasm and kind of the earliest photography of kind of seances.
Yeah.
Where almost like a flaw in the medium, and then obviously the word medium is kind of like, but a flaw in this kind of texture is then read as a hidden presence that otherwise we were unaware of.
Yeah, like a light leak, I think is the camera
is that the,
term.
Yeah, it's interesting how
but
much you will look
is,
for something.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're told it's there, you are kind of scanning these incredibly smudged photos.
I know, as a piece of sort of production and design, it's deliberately kind of unsophisticated.
So. Yeah, because it was interesting actually from reading the Gat, like, I guess one, like, when you're so used to reading galleries, and so I was kind of thinking, oh, this is kind of crappy, kind of, but obviously.
And then when you got the real thing.
And then I was like, oh, like, but, and then realized I'd be sort of misreading it because like I'd been expecting, as it were, suddenly bigger production value or something, or, you know, sharper definition, especially because I think we're so used to this idea that now all images should be in kind of.
And we can produce that at home. Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of just, that interesting thing of you realizing that actually everyone can look the same almost in a bad photo, like it becomes impossible.
Yeah.
And I think quite, well, actually kind of, because although there's a huge amount of sadness, like there's a lot of, I think, kind of comedy in this. And especially like there's one like kind of very involved story of kind of the various people who've lived in a house and their kind of, the exes, the kind of, and you start thinking like, I could believe that any of these people, if you just say this is Betty or, you know, like, it's interesting how much we are prepared to believe a caption.
I know. Yeah. And how much, by definition, a caption describes a photograph, not necessarily a painting or illustration.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a strange little marriage that they have, that we're being deceived by both.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. I'm a little down on photography right now. It's a lie. I don't know, I want to know what it was like to not have photography in the world. I mean, I publish photography books, it's not like I'm anti-photography, but I'm so curious as to what it's doing to our senses evolutionarily. Like,
what do you think it is doing?
It's maybe making our sense of smell weaker or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what I think it's doing.
Okay.
So, like, walk around with a blindfold on and your sense of smell.
And your sense of smell is kind of fun.
But something. It's got it. Like, our thumbs are getting bigger and our stuff is happening. And I think photography is definitely doing something to our sense of trust and to our sense of ghosts and to our sense of what we expect, what we're violated by. You know, we're violated by pictures. We're, you know, now pictures can be proof instead of presence, a signature, a handshake, like, I don't know.
And do you think it's changing our relationship to language as well?
Like, I'm trying.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we don't have an alphabet for, we all know what a latte shot looks like now. Like, I use this example, I don't even know why, because it's so stupid. When you shoot your latte down like that, and we all, like, if we see the latte, we kind of understand who took that picture, how much they make, what is on the table next to them. Like, it's so, you know, it's Warburg. Like, can we talk about Warburg a little bit?
Let's do it.
Maybe Warburg, you know, he essentially says when you look at a picture, you have to understand why that picture exists. And that is the reading of a photo. And, you know, we don't have an alphabet for that exactly, but Warburg started one. A.B. Warburg was this cultural theorist who essentially said the transmission of ideas happens through images and iconography more than it happens through language and words. And I think his ideas have come to pass. And so when you say, will it change language? I think yes, yeah. Like, definitely.
Well, I don't know, because like, what I think is interesting here is it almost made me think the cliche almost is that now we're in this era of pure spectacle and left.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Well, that the image is paramount. And then one of the things that I found interesting about this was thinking, oh, but all the images we see are commented images, actually, that like Instagram is a kind of, of course it is all about the image, but it's also all about the comments underneath, and you've got a lovely little kind of parody of like Instagram and kind of...
But now anyone under 12 doesn't caption their images, but they'll comment. So there's also just this elimination.
But it's still language, it's just the image is never allowed to be on its own as a pure image.
The comment, you mean with the comments now, yeah. It'll get there.
You think so?
I don't know, there's a story in the book. I was here last summer, and I was listening to Gareth Evans and Jeff Dyer talk here, and they were talking about Winogrand, if I'm not mistaken. Was anyone? And what they discovered after Winogrand's death was a huge amount of film that he took as a practice he took and never intended to develop. And so there's Winogrand's, was it Winogrand? I'm sure it was Winogrand. There's Winogrand's images there. And he meant them to stay latent. And this was so exciting to me as a practice. He's sort of like, that's how I see, almost like that's how I breathe. I am this artist, but I don't need the photograph to prove it. That's the one of the last stories in the book. There's sort of this, the latency of the latent image, the kind of what's there in the unexposed film is, I think, what I'm really interested in now, or how it's still there and is always there. I want to look there.
One of the things I want to go back almost to the beginning of the book is the title.
Sure.
Like, there's a series of puns running through this of guests and geists and ghosts. And and it made me think of, like, I kept thinking you were going to bring up the Duchamp joke, you know, of a guest plus a host equals a ghost.
It is the same word.
And it's kind of...
Host comes from guest.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted you to just, like... It's one of those kind of titles where... with it, some, you know, kind of the pun, it seems so strong that I kind of feel like, did this whole, you know, almost that the project kind of gets determined almost by the title, kind of where in this kind of process did the title come to you?
Okay, it came very late. First, this whole thing was called Kent House, because it was going to be focused on architecture and houses. And then it was called The Ghost Book or something. And then this is sort of a ghost story. I have a friend who died in 2007. And he was a writer, an incredibly good, sort of an experimental writer. And he loved Sebald. But I was reading Sebald about 3 or 4 years ago for a course that I teach. And I recently re-found the book where I was reading it and made notes. And I saw this page. And I'd underlined this section where he talks about Austerlitz's language becoming a metaphysic, or something like that. And then I'd written at the top, are the places I once was ghosts? Adam, what did Adam write in my parents' guest book? Adam poem, guest book. And it turns out in 1995, when he was 25, he visited my parents' house, and my parents have a guest room, and in the guest room there's this silly little guest book that nobody signs, covered in flowers. And Adam had written in his spidery handwriting, BP Specters. There's a Canadian poet called BP Nichols, died when he was 43, actually. And Adam wrote, a geist, a gust, a ghost, a ghast, I guess, a guest. November 1995, Bert Lahr. He signed it Bert Lahr because he loved Bert Lahr. He loved Beckett. Bert Lahr was Beckett's kind of extension of his, you know, he was his actor in the States, not in England, but in the States. Bert Lahr played the Cowardly Lion, but he also did Beckett's plays. And so I found that, and then I thought, oh, that's the title of my book. That didn't go over too well. And actually, Sheila was like, make it a geist, a gust, a ghost, I guess. Or make it, and then I just narrowed it. And then I thought, oh, well, where I found it is the title. I found it in my parents' weird, flowery guest book. Yeah. That is enough of a, and then, it was sort of, is it stories? Is it ghost stories? And then Becky Salatan, my American editor, said, well, we can put ghost stories on the cover. And I sort of rallied against that. And then she said, well, what if we deboss it? So I was like, okay, fine. So ghost story, yeah.
But can you talk a bit more about guests?
Guests, yes. Okay, well, to talk about guests, like, we all know what it feels like to be a guest. It is not ourselves.
Yeah.
It's not ourselves. To be a host, it's also not ourselves, but possibly more ourselves. I mean, you're either one or the other. You're either a better better guest or a better host. And they are both the same word. I'm a horrible guest. I'm almost too good at guests. I'm nervous, and I want to do the dishes, and you can't keep me out of the kitchen. And like, I think I make my hosts really nervous, and that version of myself I really wanted to think about. Also, the idea of these moments and occasions when you do invite guests, weddings, funerals, birthdays, parties, again, are these theaters, and stuff gets played out, and you're not yourself, and often photographs are taken. And so I'm really interested in the guest. It's also just the idea of parasitic, and there's a story in the book about the Greenland shark, which is this horrible, amazing animal that lives for 400 years, goes slowly blind because parasites attach themselves to their eyeballs, and nobody knows evolution or biologically why this happens. So they glow blind, and they're just getting bigger and bigger and running into carcasses of snow bears and eating them, and then eating ships, and they just, like, the Inuit and whalers have always sort of killed them, but then half of them will swim away. Like, they're really kind of monstrous. And I pair that with the idea of service and wealth and kind of how people order people around when there is this kind of when you're a guest but you're also ordering your host around situation. And also the idea that wealth does sort of often sort of accumulate and makes you go blind a little, in some cases. The parasite over these eyes, I felt, was a great metaphor for the sort of blindness that can happen when you have a lot of money.
Yeah, there's another kind of political story I felt in the iceberg and the sort of hotel restaurant notes, which seem
similarly pointed. It was about the Titanic and all those guests on the Titanic, just like dying. It's just one of the best and worst stories of our like of the world. And that the cover is the George Reams was a passenger on the Titanic because he was a man. He couldn't get on a lifeboat, so he jumped at the end. He just jumped and swam away from the ship and managed to get on a collapsible and stand in this ice water for all night. And he was dragged aboard the Carpathia and survived. At the inquest, he was asked by a group of lawyers because he said, well, I was on the ship, that this white thing passed by my window, and then in the morning there was this ice field and there was a really big iceberg there. So, and he said, I can't remember if he said, I think that was the one, but he was like, the biggest one, there was a really big one. And so the lawyer said, well, can you draw it? And so he drew it on a piece of lined paper, and it looked like that. And it, to me, it just looks sort of like a child's drawing of a chair with a sheet over it, which relates to sort of this M.R. James story in the book. And but this is the most reliable image we have of the iceberg that sank the Titanic. There were a bunch of people on the Carpathia that morning that had cameras, and they're like, that must be it. That must, so there's all these images out there, photographs of the iceberg that sank the Titanic. But this is, in his memory, this is it. Like, it's what we got. So I love that that was an artifact and is an artifact in public domain now.
I like it because also it kind of goes back to the your Aschenbach watercolors, because it's another outline. It's like another after image, which I feel like kind of...
an abstraction.
I'm being told that we're talking too much.
Okay.
And that we need to let other people talk.
I'd love to.
Does anybody have a Julianne?
Does anyone believe in ghosts?
There's
Jacqueline.
That was fabulous. It's like you were performing your book, Leanne, so it was wonderful to listen to you both. But I was very struck by what you said about wanting to think about a time before photography. And I was very struck when you answered Adam by saying that what you thought images had done to us is make us smell more or less. I can't remember which it was, less. But don't you think also it's all made us see less in a way? And I was just thinking of Godard's statement, I can't remember which film it is, where he says, shut your eyes and see. Mm-hmm. Or Freud on the blindness of the seeing eye. So I feel there's something going on here about how the plethora of the image, it's all not just fraudulent, that's a cliche, but it's all ghosts, and that that's what you're tapping into in some way.
I hope I'm tapping into it. There is just... In a lot of thinkers and forms of art and scientists, I mean, Einstein had a moment, and I'm gonna, if someone knows about Einstein more than I do, jump in, where he talks about a limit beyond which he couldn't explain, and it made him nervous, and it was uncanny, and he couldn't go there. And so there is always this place that we know is there and don't know how to see or talk about or feel or exist in. And I really don't want to be, oh, those are the good old days before there was, because I do think we're seeing and learning more. I do think, you know, that whole that people say, oh, we're only using 10% of our brain. And I think now we're maybe using 12 because of photography, because of how we can read now. And you can send a picture of a latte and I'm in Brisbane, or like whatever. Like, it does say something that we all understand without a caption. But we might be using 12% of our brain, but I wonder, again, are we using our body, our corporal body less too, and sort of the incorporality, if I'm pronouncing that right, of the photo and of the image, and then sort of how does it affect our sense of intuition, smell, taste, all of these things that without electricity, we're not going to disparage electricity, but, you know, all of these things were different. And so, like, it's not a new idea, but you know what I'm saying. I'm not answering your question at all. This is what I do. You say something or ask me a question and I just go off on it. Yeah, lose myself. No, it's interesting to think of just these places where it bumps up against, edges.
Do you think it's necessarily a bad thing if the world is getting more ghostly?
Who doesn't want to be more spiritual? Faith, I mean, faith. It's, I wonder if a different sense of faith will happen because we will either, we'll sort of put trust and faith in images and then start to distrust them once we're either let down or we develop another sense of faith. I mean, that's again what Warburg talks about, like, in terms of, talking about sort of Catholic religion, but the Pietà, the first instance of the Pietà was this Vesper build, it was called, was in 13th century Germany, and they needed to do it to sort of teach Christianity and Catholicism to feel the pity and to feel the grief. And so that's an icon and an image just sort of going, well, believe in this because look at this feeling and like... I don't know. I also think climate change. I'm going to melt.
You talked about repetition and about how images and the text interact. And I just had this experience, and it relates to a watercolor, the one that I have just, because I'm a great Thomas Bernhard fan.
Okay.
And I've got a new edition where you have the watercolor on the cover, the concrete one. Yeah. And I kept coming back to the cover and seeing how, you know, the light would change the colors, and when it was natural light was one way or the other. And in a way, it was sort of a dialogue between the way that Thomas Bernhard will use same words and repeat in different places, and you see the whole construction. And I thought that was something fascinating and not in any way, you know, demeaning or whatever. So I think there's also sort of a positive way where they can interact in more abstract levels.
Yeah, well, I think the more you abstract something from the familiar, the more meaning it can have, both personal and metaphorical. That's interesting that you did that with the Bernhard. I mean, he's amazing.
More of an observation. I was just thinking about when we all used to have dark rooms, and just that image of the, you would take a photograph and then you would put it in the negative in the bath, and and that was such a ghostly image, and how we've kind of lost that. The photograph began always as a ghost. And then I was thinking about what you were saying about the plethora of images. I was just talking to a friend about, for some of us who are slightly older, how National Geographic or something like that, you know, that we didn't have so many images. There were many less images, you know, 50 years ago than there are now. And that how, when you're talking about all these different kinds of images, how all of those are a bit ghostly. All these lives lived where you only, instead of interacting with them personally, you know, in everyday life, you're seeing all these sort of ghost lives of your friends or people you've met just sort of flickering, and whether or not you enter into those realities, and how much you've sort of recreated that feeling, that you've sort of manifested a feeling that I think we all have now, but in an object. So that's just a really interesting thing and beautiful thing to have done.
Yeah, there's that time lapse. Well, there's the time lapse of a picture developing, and now there's a time lapse where you'll say, we did a selfie, if we did this, and then we're like, hey, look at it. And we're, you know, we're sort of going, we're editing ourselves by, oh, that one sucks, let's do it again. And then there's this some strange, so we're developing something again, but it's weird. Like, it's fast, and it's, I don't know, this idea of slowing stuff down either by abstraction or by trying to imagine, or by not, you know, producing, not getting the satisfaction of a latent image and leaving it. What's the opposite of leaving it latent?
Leaving it latent.
Lying. Leaving it latent, yeah. I don't know, I wonder if, there's also a funny thing that's happening with photographs of children. Children know how to pose now. And again, this goes back to Warburg. They you know, do this, you know, or duck face, or just these sort of conventions of posing that we're all doing is, when you produce a version of yourself, I feel like that's a ghost. That's a ghost.
But is that new? I mean, like, in a way, like, I guess the convention we grew up with was the smile.
Yeah, cheese.
And like, in a sense, that's no less artificial.
Yeah. I mean, I have Taryn Simon, she doesn't smile for photographs. It's kind of amazing. A, you look pretty good when you don't smile. Like, it's not as though, like, there's just this sense of gravitas that's there when you don't smile. And so many people didn't smile for so long because they're like, you have to hold your head still for 30 seconds. So that's why all of those Matthew Brady daguerreotypes, you know, those dudes are not smiling. Yeah, it's a lie. Everyone's, you know, depressed and their marriages are falling apart and everyone's like, geez.
I'm really interested in the kind of active or kind of creative mode of reading that you cultivate in your work. The way that you kind of ask someone to maybe construct a narrative out of the pictures, the caption, this kind of thing, and whether that mode of kind of active reading or looking for like what's latent is, like whether you can direct that, whether that is like a paranoid mode of reading or whether it's like an optimistic mode of reading, like whether that is like you're looking for like conspiracy or whether you're looking for like treasure, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe you would like disagree with kind of like putting it within that binary, but I just was interested to hear more of that, more about the way you would describe that.
I don't think it's a conspiracy, but I think it's like a license, like a language or a license. It's something that we learn how to do. And I do think, again, it's optimistic, but we should, as Warburg suggests, look at where the pictures are coming from. Is it propaganda? Is it selling you something? Is it political? Is it creepy? What exactly do we see when, what are we being told when we see a grapefruit or a latte? There's like, why this image? Why is it produced? I mean, I often say this, like if, when I post on Instagram, it's because I'm depressed and lonely. Like we're all in these moments, like who, you don't do it when you're happy. Like, and yet you post these pictures of like, look how awesome. And it's, so there's, you know, there, it's optimistic in some ways and also sort of really a mirror, really a sort of when you go deep into why these pictures are produced, there is a story there. There is some reason. It's not always what we see. So,
sort of actually related to that last question, but I guess when I first had a look at the book and the title, I was thinking a bit about like in Greek tragedy where like guests and hosts are such a kind of formative part of many of those plays, mm-hmm. and the trust and the contract that's there.
Yeah.
And actually, I was thinking also when you're talking about Alcestis, who, you know, his wife is dead, but he still has to play the role of host and welcome people into his house. And then when they find out that's happened, they bring the wife back as a ghost into the house. And it's all, I feel like, you know, and you talked about as well how guest, host, enemy, all those words are really closely connected in Greek. And that idea of a contract. You were saying we're not ourselves, but that idea of that strong contract between hosts and guests. When you call your book Guest Book, what kind of a contract are you hoping to have, I guess, with reader-writer or like living and dead? Do you see there's like a, I don't know, do you think there's a trusting or a suspicious type of relationship?
Uh-huh. I mean, a guest book is something you sign. I'm trying to think this through out loud. I mean, a guest book is something you sign. So as a writer, am I inviting the reader of the book to kind of put themselves in it? I think maybe that's what I'm trying to do. Also, by leaving these gaps of interpretation and gaps of memory, I'm sort of saying, if I don't show you the literal illustration of what this caption is, or don't caption what you're seeing, I'm inviting you to do some of the writing, essentially. And fill in, especially with the stories, the dream stories, where the captions are very, very, very minimal. I think it's an invitation more than anything, and that's what I do with my other books too. It's sort of, I'm asking you all to make the connective tissue yourself, because again, that is what I know we all know how to do because of how we read layout and design, and so I think that's, I've never thought of it before, so thank you. But maybe that's what I'm doing. Yeah, it's a good question. But we were talking about ghosts and stories too, and just how they were so matter of fact. I mean, maybe they still are, and I'm not reading enough. Well, I am reading enough contemporary fiction. Dickens had incredible ghost stories, Christmas Carol being the most famous one. Joy, you know, The Dead, I consider a ghost story. Hamlet is just like, they're just they're walking around everywhere in our stories. We were talking about Helen of Troy and your theory about how Helen might have been an apparition or an Eidolon. I mean, I can't speak to that so much, but I feel like our trust in them is, again, already latent. And it's just been fun to read so many and try to address it. Sorry, questions?
I was just thinking that we had a conversation not long ago, which you said in passing, well, there are no spirit photographs in this book because, you know, all photographs are spirit photographs, like, obviously. And
Right? And
I thought that, well, yeah, of course, that's true. But, you know, you were talking about the ectoplasm and the medium
the
photographs.
And,
all of those, you know, is what you meant by this. And the fairy photograph, all of those, that tradition of spirit photography. Yeah. But you're sort of replacing spirit photography with all photography.
But
you know,
I love the optimism again of spirit photography, because the spiritualists were the first people to embrace photography as this, well, of course, this is how we can communicate with the dead. We miss our departed. This is how this technology will allow us to see. I mean, it all comes from yearning and missing and love, I think. And so, you know, there's that saying, all love stories are ghost stories or something like that. Didn't somebody say that? Was it Wallace or every love story is a ghost story? Something like that. I do think, I mean, spiritualist photography is so funny to look at now, but I do think it was the beginning of the potential of, and it did bring the technology along. It was the spiritualists and their enthusiasm for the form. It wasn't architects, it wasn't sort of, it was the spiritualists that brought the technology along out of this, you know, out of death and loss. And I mean, this book is about death and loss, and it's about, you know, divorce to some degree and sort of how to live with the dead, like the dead relationship. And yeah. So there's a lot of, I do think photography and grief also go hand in hand in a way that we're not looking at really clearly anymore. Not again, I don't mean to be all down in like good old days or anything. Exciting. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.